Good morning and welcome to Launch. We are broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Ron Reardon. I'm joined here in the studio by our producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee. How are you doing today?
I'm a little pollinated, Ron. I don't know if you noticed, but there's this yellow stuff all over the place.
It's kind of senseless to go wash your car today because 1 second later after you wash it, it's going to be covered with that yellow stuff.
Do you think I can get a patent on that?
No.
I think Any pollen remover patents out there?
I'm sure there probably is. I've never searched that area, but I'm sure that there's somebody that's thought about pollen removers. And I think they're probably called, you know, saran wrap or something. I don't know.
That's right. You got to shrink wrap yourself, right?
That's correct. Well, you know, Lee, on Launch, we feature innovators and inventors and entrepreneurs, you know, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from the both the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we're going to be featuring Brad Kroos of Kroos Law and Premier Trademark. But before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure. The sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Okay, super. Well, we're going to be interviewing Brad Kroos of Premier Trademark. And Premier Trademark's a service of Kroos Law, which is a patent and trademark law firm that's located here in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And Premier Trademark provides trademark search and trademark registration services for those clients that want to protect their business names, their product names, service names, logos, and taglines. So welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Okay. I know trademarks, a lot of times, calls will come in with people saying that they want a trademark when they really want a patent, or they'll say they want a patent when they really, you know, want to get a trademark. Exactly what is a trademark?
The easiest way to think of a trademark is the synonym for a brand name. For example, if you're a consumer at a grocery store and you're, you know, walking down the aisle, you're inundated with all sorts of choices of, you know, possible options to buy. Those are often marked with particular names or branding or labels, and it helps you identify the source of the goods so that you know that when you're buying a particular product, you know who the actual owner and source of the goods would be. So think of it in terms of just being most synonymous with the term brand name.
Okay, so if it's something like Scrunchy or Coca-Cola or something, those are trademarks?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the benefit to a business, especially when they're getting started, to having a registered trademark?
If a business has a registered trademark either for the business name or perhaps one or more products that it sells or services that it offers, if it attains a registration for that federally, it can bar others from using either that exact same name for the same type of services or goods or for something that's very similar. In other words, sounds the same or looks the same and kind of just a one-off name or something like that where someone's trying to copy. It offers protection to allow the owner of the trademark to prevent others from copying.
Okay. Now, like hypothetically, say like there's a, I'm sure the trademark on the Hershey Kiss, since that's sitting in front of us right here. If I came up with Lee's Chocolate Kiss, like could they then go after me and say you can't call it that? That's too close to my name and my product.
I don't know the nature of what they have trademarked, but if say for example they have a registered federal trademark for Kiss pertaining to some kind of chocolate product or whatever.
Right.
They very likely would have issue with you coming up with that as a product name for you.
And then, but it's the responsibility of Hershey's then to go after me, not the government, right?
The government is not the enforcer. The owner of the trademark essentially has to be policing use of the mark.
And so it's their responsibility to be on the lookout for people that are kind of using similarly named?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, wow. So it seems like now it's a job.
Yes.
You get a trademark, now you have a job attached to that.
What most owners of trademarks will do, especially the more valuable they are and the more money that's on the line, is will subscribe to a monitoring service where you provide, you know, somewhat similar to like Google Alerts where a person wants to see, hey, how much am I out there on the internet or tell me
right.
if my name's mentioned in the media. You can do that in terms of trademarks where you provide a list to this monitoring service. And if anything that's the same or similar or very close spelling to yours a new application is filed for that, then you'll get an alert. And at that point, you'll know, hey, I better go take action on this if it's, you know, too close for comfort.
I know a lot of times when people are launching a new business and they've just basically got an idea on a napkin, that sometimes they are in a hurry saying, well, I've got to get a federally registered mark for this name because I don't want anybody else to steal it. Any recommendations as to the timing of when to file for a registered mark?
It varies. In filing for a federal trademark registration, you can file based on actual use, which means, for example, that you already have that product or service in use in commerce, you have customers, or there's a product available for people to buy. Alternatively, if you know that you have something that you know, in good faith will be launching 6, 12, 18 months down the road, you can file based on intent to use, meaning that you essentially want to reserve that name. You'll get a filing date when you file the application for that, and you would want to go ahead and do that even if you're not ready to go to market with your product, if you've already finalized the choice of name or names that you want the trademark protection for. What you do is, once it then becomes in use, procedurally and legally, there are a couple steps you have to take to basically prove that that is being used once it is in use in commerce, and send in sample specimens like product labels, et cetera, to show that it's in use. So for a business owner, it's sort of an it depends answer. If you already have finalized the name and there's not a chance that that might change, it's probably worth going ahead and filing the application if you have an intent to use that at some point in the future.
Okay. Because I guess where I was going was that if somebody's, you know, invented what's going to be a new commercial, a consumer product, and at the beginning they feel like everybody's going to want one, but they, you know, it's unproven, they don't really know, is this thing really going to sell? Or perhaps, you know, maybe they're going to be providing a service, maybe a new restaurant or, you know, new clothing line or whatever. But from a timing standpoint, if they go ahead and get the trademark and then the business goes belly up after 1 year, then they pretty much have tossed away their money on getting the trademark, have they not?
That is true. Luckily, trademark applications there is fees associated with that, both attorney fees and government filing fees, et cetera, but it's not cost prohibitive to prevent somebody who wants to not have that risk of having the name taken should they be a success versus if they do have to walk away from it and the product or the business isn't a success. The risk there is just the loss of the application fees.
Okay, so it's kind of hedging your bets. You know, you think well, you know, I think this is going to be successful, so let's lock down the name, and that name's going to be valuable, and you're not out of pocket that much money.
Right.
Okay. So what's the difference really between a service mark, a trademark, and a trade name?
Historically, a service mark is what was referred to when somebody offered a service, like, for example, myself, being an attorney, I offer legal services. I don't have an actual product that you can go and buy off the shelves at a store like you could, say, a grocery item at a grocery store. If I were to brand my business, what I would be getting is a service mark, or say like a consultant or somebody like that as well. A trademark historically has been where you actually have a product or an item, and you're going to be putting a label or a hang tag on that, and you're putting your trademark on that. Legally speaking, they're largely synonymous. Often they're always or all referred to as a trademark, whether you're talking about a trade name or trademark or service mark. Legally, they're all sort of grouped together and just collectively referred to as a trademark. And the application process is the same regardless of whether your mark is actually a trademark or a service mark.
Okay. Well, there's a company in town that I'm familiar with that they had gotten a trademark on the phrase good to go for restaurant services because they owned a series of restaurants here. And one day, several years ago, they were watching TV and saw a commercial by a well-known fast food company that had in their commercial good to go. And when they contacted them saying, I'm sorry, you know, you got to quit using it. That's our mark, you know. And the response was, well, no, we don't want to quit using it. You know, how much do you want for us to be able to use the mark? And it turned out to be very lucrative for them. So that's a case of, you know, Lee was asking about, you know, who does the monitoring. In this case, the monitoring was just watching TV and seeing a commercial, and hey, that's my mark right there.
But that was just pure random chance.
Pure random chance. Yeah, it wasn't a service like Brad was talking about earlier. You know,
right.
That was monitoring the use of it. And, you know, that got me curious, and I went and looked up the phrase good to go and found that it's trademarked about 10 different ways.
For different
T-shirts
right.
and other kind
so you
of
have
stuff.
To trademark it, and you have to pay for each individual category?
You do. If you're, say, a business owner and you have five different product lines that, in terms of the way the trademark office classifies them, they would fall in five different classes. You pay a per-class fee. For example, the government fee for most applications is $325 per class. So if you're filing with products in their diverse products in five different classes, it would be five times that fee. If, say, you're the company and you just have one product and you want to, we use your example of Good to Go, and say you're in the restaurant services classification and somebody else wants to use Good to Go for like apparel or something, in, you know, sporting goods, a totally different class. As long as the marks have not attained what's referred to as a famous mark status, you can usually differentiate your marks and the distinctiveness of them based on channels of trade. In other words, a person who's going to a restaurant and recognize the branding of Good to Go, they're not going to be confused when they then go to buy a shirt or clothing item that the name Good to Go was used representing the apparel.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got the brand name, you know, like Starbucks or something like that, and we've got this tagline, you know, Good to Go. What other items could be trademarked other than just a name or a tagline?
At a high level, you might get what's referred to as a word mark, which is just the name itself, like a company name or a product name, without any claim to color or style or design. Subsequent to that, you might consider filing for a logo. If your brand has got consumers recognizing a particular color or style, artistic or ornamentation aspects of it, you can get a trademark on a stylized design. You also mentioned the taglines. There are numerous taglines that can be trademarked. In the more creative categories, one company I'll mention just as an example, Owens Corning with their fiberglass insulation. Everyone who has seen that will probably be quick to think, oh yeah, that's pink insulation. They have protected that as a color. So it doesn't mean that others can't obviously manufacture or sell insulation, but they can't do it with the color pink in the United States if there's a U.S. trademark for that. As well as sounds, the NBC chimes is probably the most famous example of a sound that could be trademarked. Even in the perhaps even further odd would be smells. There's a famous case where a lady who manufactured a particular type of sewing thread, and she wanted the others who were using that thread in their sewing activities to recognize it by the scent of it. And there was a particular floral blossom. I don't recall that particular flower, but the scent of that flower was somehow embedded into the sewing thread, and she has a trademark on that as well.
They infused it in there, huh?
Yes.
So what other things could be trademarked?
You could do shapes, like, for example, the shape of a bottle is something that you could do, as long as it's, you know, not specific to the functionality of what that bottle's being used for. If it's more the way it looks and basically speaks back to what, you know, trademarks are all about, identifying the source of the goods. In other words, if that shape of the bottle, when a consumer or potential consumer sees that, they always know that, hey, that's this particular beverage bottler company or manufacturer, that can serve as a trademark as well.
Okay. And I want to tell our younger listeners that who might not be familiar with the chimes from NBC that was bung, bung, bung.
You think that's what it was?
More or less. More or less.
Are they going to have a trademark infringement on Ron now for that?
No.
This is for educational purposes. Hopefully we can stay away from that.
Perhaps a more contemporary sound would be the theme for the Harlem Globetrotters. That's a sound that was as well. So
the song or just that music?
That music, that background music, that little ditty was trademarked. And another one is the MGM Studios, which I believe this is still in use, at the end or beginning of shows that were, you know, put together by that producer, would have that lion roar of Leo the lion.
Right.
And that was a trademark sound as well.
That's incredible. So what's really the difference between a trademark, a patent, and a copyright, Brad?
All three of those fall within the umbrella of intellectual property law, and additionally, trademark law will sort of overlap into business law or what they call unfair competition law. But in terms of intellectual property law, each of those three has a different aspect or angle in which it's going about to protect some aspect of a company's intellectual property. They have different application processes, different review processes, and examination processes. Once one is registered or awarded or issued, they have various lengths as far as how long they last. In other words, how long the owner has enforceable rights. But at a high level, as we mentioned earlier, a trademark is essentially a brand name. Those last indefinitely. As long as a company that owns a particular trademark is still using it and the mark has remained distinctive to identify the source of goods, and so long as the owner is paying the renewal fees to the government, there are certain renewal fees or maintenance fees, as they're referred to, that are paid along the way to keep the mark in a live status and active. Those will last indefinitely. A copyright, think of persons who have written a magazine article or a book or perhaps the lyrics to a song. Anything that is a work of authorship can be protected by copyright protection. Those last for the life of the author plus 7 years, so they do last a long time, but they ultimately will expire. They wouldn't go on indefinitely like a trademark. And a patent is used to protect an actual invention. If an inventor has come up with a new functional way of doing something, or the structural product of something to protect, or even a design element could be protected in terms of patent protection. And depending on the type of patent, whether that's, for example, a design patent, the term on that is typically 14 years, or the functionality protected under a utility patent application is essentially something less than 20 years, depending on how long it took for the patent to go through the application process.
Okay. Well, I've heard it stated before that when you start a business, the very first question you should ask is, how am I going to sell this business? So I guess it's smart for a business owner to be looking at intellectual property and saying, okay, trademarks, copyrights, patents, you know, what do I need to put together so that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, when I actually sell this business, you know, what kind of intellectual property will I have to be able to sell?
That's definitely true. Sometimes it's the portfolio approach that works best. A company or an inventor or business owner might have just a single item that needs protected, such as the company name with a trademark, but it may be that it's an inventor who has a new product, also has some manuals or books that go along with it that might need copyright protection, or perhaps a website design for promotion and sale of the product that could be benefit from copyright protection, and there would also be trademarks to protect the brands of the product or the company name. So you could have sort of a portfolio approach to protecting as many of the aspects of intellectual property as possible, and that opens the owner of all that up to all sorts of opportunities with either licensing or outright selling of that business and the associated intellectual property at some point in the future.
Yeah, I read one story years ago that there was a company that actually bought the Rolls-Royce company. And after they made that purchase, to their chagrin, they realized that they had not purchased the trademark to Rolls-Royce, that there was a separate owner of that. And in all of their, you know, due diligence and all like that, they had not turned up the fact that they owned the company but not the trademark.
Right. That does happen. Another famous one was the Hooters restaurant chain. They went through and built a successful restaurant franchise and only after the fact realized, oh, we have a trademark situation, to go back after the fact and remedy. So
it probably costs more after the fact, I would guess.
Yes, that's a safe assumption.
That's something. Well, I also read somewhere that words like elevator and zipper used to be trademarked, but they're not anymore, that they kind of became generic. What happened there?
What that is based on is a concept called genericide. When a person or a business wants to file for use as a trademark or is using a trademark in the federal system, over time through case law and various analysis of marks, they have sort of a spectrum or a scale of what is called the distinctiveness of the mark. And it essentially starts at the top level as far as being most distinctive of something that's like a coined or fanciful mark. Like Kodak was essentially a made-up or coined name to refer to film or, you know, photography products. Suggestive marks, like, for example, copper tone or something, you wouldn't necessarily know when you first hear that that's a sunblock. But if you, after the fact, hear that that's what it is, you're like, oh, okay, that referring to a copper toned skin makes sense as a sun lotion or something. Descriptive marks initially cannot be registered as a trademark because they essentially tell the consumer or potential consumer what the product is, and the risk is that it could bar other competitors or other people to be in the business selling that particular type of product. But over time, a trademark can be allowed if what's called acquired distinctiveness or secondary meaning is achieved. Like if you've used that as a trademark for over 5 years and you have, you know, customers who are loyal to you and recognize that as a brand name and source of goods, the trademark office will allow registration of that. Generic marks, for example, like the terms facial tissue, you could never get a trademark on that because it's generic. It tells you exactly what it is. But if you had a unique name, say like Puffs or Kleenex, that don't tell you what the product is, you could. The situation that you've mentioned, the marks were initially either descriptive or perhaps even suggestive, but over time they have been exposed so much and misused in commerce. And there's a certain set of standards you'll want to follow as an owner of a trademark to prevent this from happening. But what happened was it became generic, and it lost its distinctiveness. A common example, I would sure everyone is familiar with the search engine on the internet for Google. You've probably all heard the phrase when somebody says, "Oh, I'm going to go Google that," or what they mean is, "I'm going to go search that using the Google internet search engine." You need to be careful in use of your trademark as the owner of it, and not use it as a verb, but use it more like the adjective, like it's the brand name. And when you mentioned like the zipper and the other mark, that's what happened. They became generic over time and lost their distinctiveness.
Okay. Well, you know, you mentioned this thing that was suggestive, but then what was the one below suggestive? Descriptive?
Descriptive.
I know there's an attorney in town that successfully got the trademark The DUI Lawyer, okay, for legal services. And initially they turned him down. He says, I'm sorry, you can't have this. But his trademark attorney offered all kind of documentation that at least here in the Atlanta area, he is known as the DUI Lawyer. He's got a radio program, you know, he's advertised that, you know, and he was successful in overcoming the objections and actually getting the DUI Lawyer as his registered trademark.
Right. I don't know the details of that particular application, but it sounds like what argument or logic ultimately prevailed is that by that attorney having that as his brand name, he's not barring anybody else from holding himself or herself out as an attorney who specializes in, you know, helping clients with DUI matters. Others can still be in that area of law. They just can't use that particular brand name. And what the trademark office wants to prevent is a name that's so generic or descriptive that it essentially shuts out anybody else from being in that business and basically monopolizes an entire business category. And his mark evidently does not do that as far as the trademark office was.
Do you think they do a good job?
I do. Every now and then, particularly after, you know, having seen a large volume of trademark applications and registrations go through, I'd say as a whole they do a good job. Sometimes you'll see basically there are some that are just close calls. Like if I, you know, just made up a mark and said, well, do you think that's generic or descriptive? You might each have a slightly different take on that. Examiners are the same way in their assessment of it. And sometimes it's frustrating if you see what might at first glance appear to be an inconsistency, but they do try to look at every mark and application objectively and be fair and consistent.
Okay. Well, the circle R versus the TM, what's really the difference between putting a TM beside your company name and putting a circle R?
Okay. I'll start with the circle R. If you are using a trademark or have a trademark, you can only use the circle R notice or notation if you have a federal registration that backs that up. In other words, you've received from the U.S. Trademark Office an official registration number that says that's your official trademark and we have it registered, you can use the circle R. TM is someone who has a trademark, they're using it and perhaps on a business or a product, and they're basically asserting to everybody that sees that, hey, that's my trademark, but they've not gone through the process of filing for a federal trademark registration. And what that, just in terms of the difference in the notations, what that is pointing out is the difference between federal trademark law, and what was before federal trademark law came into existence was common law trademark rights. And prior to the Lanham Act, which I believe came into being in 1946, which made this whole concept of a federal trademark registration, you attained trademarks just by using it. Like if you opened up a particular barbecue restaurant, say, under a certain name in the Atlanta metropolitan area, you, under common law trademark rights and under state law, could enforce that as a trademark. But if somebody came up with that exact same name, but you know, it was in good faith, not in bad faith, say in Birmingham, Alabama, where for restaurants, obviously the customers would not have any overlap, you couldn't do anything about it. In other words, you could have multiple people using the same names. Now, in the current system where federal registrations are available, that same restaurant who's based in Atlanta, who has customers from all over this area and perhaps some that come in from out of state, could file the federal trademark application, attain that registration, and basically put the entire U.S., all states and territories, on constructive notice that that's my trademark and I'm using it essentially everywhere. Even if that restaurant owner, for example, doesn't have a restaurant in California, they could prevent somebody from starting with that same name in California.
Now, how does the internet URLs come into play in this? Like, say I have the URL for a company like Joe's Fish Restaurant. And so I own the URL. So I got, you know, I went on, I paid my $10. So now I own www.joesfishrestaurant.com. But now this guy, Joe in California, does what you said and he trademarks it and all that stuff. Does he have rights now to that over, you know, supersedes my rights to that URL?
Not if he came along after the fact. With the advent of the internet era and now all the domain names, it sort of depends on who was first, who filed what, a lot of factors to look at. There are what is referred to as anti-cyber squatting statutes. So if you are already in existence and you have a federal trademark registration for that business or restaurant, and someone after the fact says, oh, hey, I kind of like that name and I'd like to camp out on that domain name and hold it, hoping to actually attain, you know, a payout for it. In other words, you're not really acting in good faith. You didn't have intent to start a restaurant or a company by that name. You can proceed legally under statutes that protect against cyber squatting and ultimately attain that domain name or ask the domain name to be shut down or transferred over to you and stop the cyber squatter.
But like, what if my URL predates their restaurant? And even though that I'm just sitting on it because maybe in 10 years I have a dream of having a restaurant.
Right. In that case, you've not acted in bad faith. You weren't trying to essentially do what's called cyber squatting. So that particular trademark owner couldn't pursue you under those terms. They would have to show some kind of infringement under a different means to say, hey, that is actually causing harm, you know, to your trademark.
Okay.
Or to their trademark, excuse me.
Okay. We've been talking a lot about the United States, but, you know, there's also trademarks in other countries. I read many years ago that Budweiser pretty much had locked down the Budweiser name in every country except Germany, where there was already a company there predating Budweiser in the U.S. that had everything called Budweiser. I never did hear exactly how that turned out, because for a long time the German country was saying, I'm sorry, Budweiser U.S., you know, you're Johnny come lately. You know, these guys have had Budweiser before, you know.
Right. Trademarks are territorial. So, like, if you're a U.S.-based business and you want protection in the United States, you would file through the U.S. Trademark Office. But let's say you're a multinational company and you look at it in terms of where are your potential sales or potential customers. Let's say you have a huge market in Mexico and Canada just because they're geographically close. You would have to file applications for a trademark registration in those countries as well. In any country where you want that name protected, you would have to file in that particular country.
Okay. Well, in the U.S., how long does a trademark last?
As long as you're paying your renewal fees to the trademark office, and as long as it's still being used in commerce and hasn't lost its distinctiveness, in other words, become generic like we talked about earlier, it will last indefinitely.
Okay.
The renewal fees that I've mentioned a couple times, essentially, like, let's say you're issued a trademark today. Sometime after the fifth year, you have a couple of affidavits where you're going to be filing essentially a statement of use saying, I'm still using this mark in commerce and intend to continue that. you'll file an affidavit that is asserting its incontestability. In other words, it gives you additional federal rights so that others can't contest that. After, like, between the 9th and 10th years, you'll be filing renewals as well. And then after that, it's essentially every 10 years for the life of the trademark, as long as you're still using it in commerce.
And does the trademark office kind of remind you it's time to do that 5-year and 10-year, or is that something you've got to watch out for yourself?
It would be nice if they did, but they don't. It's something that a lot of business owners, it's an extra task to keep track of. Typically, for attorneys that have filed on behalf of clients, they can track all of that in a docketing system and remind their clients at the particular times that, hey, we have another renewal due for you at this time. Let's get this filed. But there are those who have filed and just forget that, and the trademark will go abandoned. If renewals aren't paid, it'll be canceled or abandoned. And also, if the trademark is not used, typically it's a 3-year period of time. If it's no longer in use, it will go abandoned as well under those circumstances.
Okay. Well, if it goes abandoned, is there any recourse, any way to revive it, give it CPR or anything?
Depending on how recently it was abandoned, there's a very small term in which you can file and pay some fees and try to get that revived. But if that's passed, you're basically looking at filing an application again, which is at least something that's nice. Assuming that nobody has come in the interim, you can quickly put together another application and file again. You'll always have that gap of unprotected time. Your hope is that no one comes onto the scene using that same name during that time.
Okay. Well, how long does it take to actually get a federally registered trademark?
It varies based on the application and how many classes it's in, or how many rejections or concerns that the examiner may have that he or she brings back to the client. But on average, if a thorough trademark ability search had been up front and it's sort of the lay of the land in that trademark space is known as far as the favorability of that mark being approved, a lot of applicants can go through from start to finish in just under a year.
Okay, that's pretty good. So what's the process that a business owner goes through to actually get a trademark right? I mean, from coming up, I mean, there's a search that has to be done at the beginning or what?
A search isn't required. However, it's recommended. What you would really hate to do is, you know, think you have a really great name for a new restaurant or new business and go ahead and file that application only to find out that somebody in another state who, you know, you had never seen in commerce and use but exists and would prevent you from obtaining a trademark registration. You'd hate to throw all that away, particularly if you've invested in, you know, signage and product labeling, and the costs on the business side could add up. The trademark application cost at that point would seem small compared to the loss of having to essentially rebrand your business. So it's certainly valuable to do the search up front, and it's a very quick process and will give you a feel for the favorability or the likelihood of that mark going through the application process. There's obviously no guarantees, but it will give you a good feel up front.
Okay. Because I know many years ago, reading a story that Google came out and said that they were going to be starting an email service and they're going to call it Gmail. And before they filed, you know, the trademark application, there was something like 3 or 4 other entities that filed trademark registrations for Gmail. I think one of them was a religious company. They were going to call it Godmail, so it was going to be Gmail. And I never did hear how, you know, what the trademark office did with all of these applications, plus, you know, the one that Google filed, you know, after a week later than these other folks. What happens in a situation like that?
Well, trademark law is based on use, so you would have to look at each of those entities and see, had they already started use in commerce? In other words, could consumers see Gmail in whichever capacity it was for each of those applicants? And you also have to take into consideration the filing date. So there's a lot of factors and a lot of variables, and I honestly don't know the specifics of how that one turned out. You also do have the situation of if the services provided are diverse, and if they all were pertaining to email services, that there's going to be some bumping of heads in that case. But if for any reason those pertain to different products or different services, there's a chance that they might be able to coexist on the register.
Good. So what all does the person do once they've got trademark rights?
You have to be careful in how you use the trademark. You want to avoid the generic use of the mark. You don't want to lose the distinctiveness of it. You want to use what's called notice. That circle R is the federal notice that you're putting with your trademark to let everybody that sees that know that that is your federal trademark rights. I can't tell you the number of times I've run across the situation where somebody actually has the federal trademark registration and you go to their website or you look at their product packaging and they've made no notation to basically let the world know that that's my federal trademark by putting that circle R on there. So you want to use diligence in keeping up with that. The other item, which is not necessarily all that fun, but is essentially policing your mark. You want to keep an eye on anybody else who may be using the same mark or getting close, because what you don't want to have happen is if somebody is out there using it and perhaps they aren't bothering or impacting your business specifically, but you don't do anything to stop them if they're using a mark on the same type of goods or services, and then perhaps a larger company comes along a little bit later, their defense, if you're trying to then assert your rights against them, their defense is, well, you've not been enforcing your rights all along to try to, upkeep the value and benefits of your trademark. So it's important to monitor those and to police them and not let others use your mark.
Okay. Well, when you say, to put the little circle R, close to your trademark name or whatever. Sometimes I've seen it as a superscript. Sometimes I've seen it as a subscript. It looks like there's really, in the ones that I've seen, that they look at like it, that little circle R could be pretty much anywhere.
The key to the use of that, there's not a rigid rule that like it has to be on the upper right corner or the lower left corner or anything like that, but it has to be on there so that people can see it clearly, and you don't want it to be ambiguous or misleading. For example, if you have a trademark on a particular logo and you're putting it that logo in use in commerce right next to something else and you're a little bit loose in the placement of that circle R, you don't want to have something that's misleading to where the consumer sees that and thinks that maybe all of that is protected. In other words, you have to be honest with the use of it and not be misleading.
Okay. Well, I know that you're on Twitter and LinkedIn, and you've got a website. Could you share, for our listeners out there that want to get in touch with you or to follow you, on your tweets and everything, could you give us that information?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. My website specific to trademarks is premiertrademark.com, and I'm also involved with Twitter and LinkedIn. On Twitter, I use the name Trademark Tweet, and on LinkedIn, I'm also Premier Trademark there for my profile.
Okay, because I'm now, you might have noticed that starting last night, I started following you on Twitter.
I did see that.
Okay, and hopefully Lee will start following you also.
Sure.
Well, Brad, thank you very much. You've really given us some really good nuggets and learnings that business owners out there can use in their launch and in their journey, especially related to trademarks.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. It's another great show, Lee.
Yes, a special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents & More, creating the currency of innovation since 2002.
Okay, tune in each week at this same time to listen live or go to our website, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, to listen at your convenience. Until next week, I'm your host, Ron Reardon, with our producer, Lee Cantor, signing off another great session of Launch.